Tonight I'm going to be talking about the Sava Sutta. It's quite a famous sutta. It's very early on in the Majjhima Nikaya. It's like the second one they put it near the front for a reason, I think. It's typically the translation I'm most familiar with is restraining and abandoning the taints. Doesn't sound very pleasant, actually, but it's actually quite an interesting sutta because it goes into great detail about dealing with taints. So for the first question, of course, is what's a taint? So here's a dictionary definition that I found that I actually like. It's called a trace of something bad, offensive, or harmful. And in particular, I want to look at the harmful part of this, because that's really what the Buddha was talking about. This isn't about, it's not a wagging finger being scolded about you're bad or offensive even. It's about, the taints are things that get in the way, obscure the mind, that get in the way of our having a fruitful practice. And that's why the Buddha put such emphasis in them. I want to read, this is from the Dhammapada. Now, the Dhammapada is a sort of a poetic collection of the teachings of the Buddha in very sort of terse language. The translation I have here is by Thanissara Bhikkhu, who's a contemporary monk who also happens to be a Pali translator. And this is from the very first section called Pairs. Phenomena are preceded by the heart, ruled by the heart, made of the heart. If you speak or act from a corrupted heart, then suffering follows you as the wheel of the cart, the track of the ox that pulls it. Phenomena are preceded by the heart, ruled by the heart, made by the heart. If you speak or act with a calm, bright heart, then happiness follows you like a shadow that never leaves. He insulted me, hit me, beat me, robbed me. For those who brood on this, hostility isn't stilled. He insulted me, hit me, beat me, robbed me. For those who don't brood on this, hostility is stilled. Hostilities aren't stilled through hostility, regardless. Hostilities are stilled through non-hostility. This is an unending truth. Unlike those who don't realize that we're here on the verge of perishing, those who do, their quarrels are stilled. I love that. Unlike those who don't realize we're on the verge of perishing. It's an interesting way to look at life in a way, because it encourages you to practice, which is, well, of course, what the Buddha was always trying to do, was encourage us to practice. So before I go any further, I also want to make it really clear, you know, as we go through these taints, that it's very easy to get caught up in imagining, oh, I've got that one and I got that one. Oh my God, I'm so full of taint, and end up just beating yourself up. Now the practice becomes this really skillful way to make yourself feel worse. This is not, absolutely not the intention here. In fact, I want to read something from Joseph Goldstein that reflects on this. This is from his book, Mindfulness. And it's a little section here called What is Skillful and What is Not. By emphasizing the recognition and knowing of the unwholesome roots and the wholesome ones in their absence, the Buddha is highlighting the wise discernment of what is skillful and what is unskillful. That is, discerning what leads to happiness and liberation and what leads to suffering. Although this discernment is basic to the Buddha's teachings, in our Western culture, it's a very delicate process. For many people, it's an easy step from recognizing a particular mind state like greed or hatred as being unwholesome to feeling that you're a bad person for having it, or that somehow it's wrong for the mind state to even arise. This pattern of reaction simply leads to more self-judgment, more aversion, and more suffering. It is not a helpful cycle. It is important to understand which mind states are skillful and which are unskillful, not in order to judge ourselves or be reactive to them, but in order to see which lead to happiness and should be cultivated in our lives, and which lead to suffering and should be abandoned. The distinction between wholesome and unwholesome mind states brings a moral dimension into psychology. This is particularly important because these different states are not only arising in our minds, but they also are what motivates our actions. So, of course, what arises in the mind then becomes an action often. So it's really important that we understand this, that this isn't about, when we call this skillful means, it's not skillful means for beating yourself up. It's skillful means to see, oh, this doesn't work. Oh, this does work. Yeah. And then going towards things that work and going away from things that don't. It's actually a very wise way of looking at the world. And then the rest of this sutta, the Buddha talks about all these different ways, all these different forms taints take and different ways of working with them skillfully. But I want to just mention one other thing, and that is that this was like a constant theme for the Buddha. In the Satipatthana Sutta, in the introduction, the very first lines of the Satipatthana Sutta, the Buddha's instructions to meditation, what he says is, bhikkhus, this is the direct path for purification of beings. Purification. Purification means getting rid of the taints, right? And so what he's saying is, this meditative practice that he's teaching is about purification. So he's very emphatic. This is like how he introduces the whole topic of meditation. And you know, he sort of cuts to the chase right away, which I think is wonderful. So now let's move on to the sutta here. So this is the Buddha talking about the destruction of taints. And then he, as the Buddha often does, he lays out this sort of list of different sort of forms that taints might take, and based on those forms, different ways to deal with them. So it's like he's looked very closely at his own mind, seeing all these taints arise in his mind and how he skillfully learned to deal with them. And he's basically sharing that information, right? So it's like, I want to read this verse here. This is verse 4 of the sutta. Bhikkhus, there are taints that should be abandoned by seeing. There are taints that should be abandoned by restraining. There are taints that should be abandoned by using. There are taints that should be abandoned by enduring. There are taints that should be abandoned by avoiding. There are taints that should be abandoned by removing. There are taints that should be abandoned by developing. So it's quite a list. The 7 different things here he's talking about. He's talking about seeing them, restraining them, using them, enduring them, avoiding them, removing them, and developing them, which is really, when you think about it, developing them is quite an interesting idea. So then he goes on and he starts, of course, he takes this list and now he amplifies it and goes on into quite some detail. And this is about seeing. This is how he attends wisely. Was I in the past? Was I not in the past? What was I in the past? How was I in the past? Having seen what did I become in the past? Shall I be in the future? Shall I not be in the future? What shall I be in the future? How shall I be in the future? Having been what shall I become in the future? Or else he is inwardly perplexed about the present. Thus, am I? Am I not? What am I? How am I? Where has this being come from? Where will it go? These are like classic existential questions, right? Then the Buddha very bluntly says, when he attends unwisely in this way, when he attends unwisely in this way, it's like you're wasting your time thinking about this stuff, is what he's saying. And I think this is great because we get caught in these sort of philosophical ramblings. They're so attractive, you know. And all philosophers, particularly Western philosophers, have struggled with these questions, right? And come up with different ways of looking at them and thinking about them and explaining them. And the Buddha is basically saying, why waste your time thinking about this stuff? Why waste your time? You know, if what he's teaching is how to be in the present moment, then all of those questions, what was I in the past? How was I? Blah, blah, blah. And same within the future. What am I right now? Am I? Am I not? Blah, blah. These are all wool gathering. So these are things that should be abandoned by seeing. Seeing, here I am. My mind is just caught in another one of these blah, blah, blah philosophical, existential wool gathering events. No need to go there. And you have to see that's what's going on. It's like instead, here's what we should be seeing, right? This is a few verses further on. He attends wisely. This is suffering. He attends wisely. This is the origin of suffering. He attends wisely. This is the cessation of suffering. He attends wisely. This is the way leading to the sensation of suffering. When he attends wisely in this way, the three fetters are abandoned in him. Personality view, doubt, and adherence to rules and observances. These are called taints that should be abandoned by seeing. So here's the other layer. By actually basically looking very deeply at the meanings of the Four Noble Truths, which is really what he just laid out there, we start to understand and we abandon these unwholesome things. This, as he said here, we have personality, the sense of a separate self, and her adherence to rules and observances, like, you know, strict religious dogma. And doubt is a tough one, but that one, so that's when we can abandon those, we can do away with them by seeing that that's what's arisen. We see them clearly and we go, I know what that is. This is the value of mindfulness. This is where mindfulness is so important, because mindfulness allows us to actually do that seeing. Mindfulness allows us to see what's arising in our mind and go, that's just one of those old taints. You know, I know what that is. I've been here before. I don't need to go there again. It's like we abandon them because we see them. We've attended wisely. And then the next section, he goes on. So that was the first one, abandoning by seeing. Then we have abandoning or destruction by restraining. What taints, bhikkhu, should be abandoned by restraining? Here a bhikkhu reflecting wisely abides with the I factor restraint. While taints, vexations, and fever might arise in one who abides with an I factor unrestrained, there are no taints, vexations, or fever in one who abides with the eye faculty restrained. And he goes on and goes through the other five sense doors. So often what we get upset about, what we get wound up about, are because something comes through one of the sense doors and we've consciously put ourselves in a place where we're taking in things that aren't wholesome. And it may just be totally accidental. You know, you're just walking down Pearl Street and someone walks by and it's like, whoa, I really like what that person looked like. You know, the mind just goes there, right? But then if you don't watch it, the mind then quickly proliferates on that thought. But if you see it, you go, oh, there I am. I'm just being caught in that vibe again. And you can just sort of, because the eye faculty at that moment wasn't restrained. You weren't paying attention. By restraining, it's like, what he means here is like, I wasn't really paying attention and I was just letting stuff come in and my mind whirl around all that stuff that's coming in through the sense doors. And we have to consciously learn to pay attention. Once again, this is what mindfulness does, because there you are being mindful and that sensation arises and you go, oh, I know where that goes. I know where that story goes. So once again, mindfulness is the key to allowing us to restrain the senses. And we're not in any sense saying, and this is really important, that having sense impressions is bad or wrong. You know, that we shouldn't have any pleasant sensations. It's just we have to be aware of how those sensations can, if we're unrestrained, lead us into unwholesome places. That's all. And then he says, then we have restraining by using. It's an interesting thought. Here we are, we have something, we're going to use it. What taints, bhikkhu, should be abandoned by using? Here a bhikkhu, reflecting wisely, uses the robe only for protection from cold, for protection from heat, from protection from contact with gadflies, mosquitoes, wind, the sun, and creeping things, and only for the purpose of concealing the private parts. Reflecting wisely, he uses alms food, and he goes through what are called the four requisites. And he says, we should only use these things because we have to, you know, here's monks, right? They have to have a robe, they have to eat, you know, their one meal a day. They have to have the medical requisites. They have to have a kutir, a place to stay. And it says you should use them, but use them without getting caught up in them. So it's restraining by using, but using them and understanding what they're there for. They're only there to basically keep this body alive and healthy. Because bodies are important. If we don't have a body, it's pretty hard to practice. Or if this body gets really sick or injured or unhealthy, it's really difficult to practice. So what he's saying is we got to take care of this body, which is what the four requisites for monks allow them to do, without getting caught up in wanting more than just the basics. You know, being content with the simplicity of things. This is what he taught to bhikkhus, the monks and nuns. And we can take that in, but at the same time, we're all householders. And with householders, he had a somewhat more open and less strict view of things. I want to read something. This is from a book called What the Buddha Taught by Walpola Rahula. And he's talking about how the Buddha talked about this sort of thing, about having stuff, which is essentially what This is about using stuff, which we all have to do. I mean, we can't function in the world. I couldn't be doing what I'm doing right now if I didn't have this computer, which is stuff. You know, so I have to have the computer so I can teach. So I have to have one. That sort of thing. It's useful. It's a tool. So here's what the Buddha had to say about these things. Once the Buddha told Anattapindika, the great banker, one of his most devoted lay disciples who founded for him the celebrated Jetavana Monastery, that a layman who leads an ordinary family life has four kinds of happiness. The first happiness is to enjoy economic security or sufficient wealth acquired by just and righteous means. So it's okay to have a job and make money, you know, as long as it's just and righteous means, right? The second is spending the wealth liberally on himself, his family, his friends and relatives, and on meritorious deeds, generosity. So it's okay to enjoy the fact that you have this money and you use it to for yourself and your family and your friends and to give generously to people who have less. The third is to be free from debt. This, I think, I'll find this very fascinating. You know, this is like, there's this guy who's on the radio, on AM radio, I used to hear driving around sometimes late at night, who had this whole thing about how important it was to be out of debt. It was like a Christian duty to be out of debt. I forget his name now. But it goes so against our culture. Our culture is all about, here's easy credit, here's this, here's that, here's spend, buy more stuff. And then think of all the suffering that arises out of that mentality of being in debt. Because once you're in debt, then you have to really do something to get out of debt, which is often stuff you don't want to do. Yeah. And I'm not saying debt is always bad. You know, in our culture, if you want to own a house, you have to have a mortgage, unless you're ridiculously wealthy and you can just buy it, but you know, write a check and take it out of your bank account. But even then, it's like, okay, now I've taken on that debt. Now I have to do what I can to get rid of it. When I was younger and worked in the world more, I bought a house with my wife and we had kids, and I paid the house off in 11 years. And that was like, okay, let's get rid of this debt. That was like one of my main objects in life. And doing that, I lived a pretty simple life in a lot of ways. And consciously so. And since then, I've been out of debt. And let me tell you, being out of debt and living in this world with no debt is like one of the best things you can do. If you want to be happy, have no debt. It really does make a difference. Okay. And according to the Buddha, this is true too, which I thought was useful. the fourth happiness is to live a faultless and pure life. Or to lead a life of virtue. So he's talking about, this is like layman. This is you and me, this is householders. This is how living in the world. It's okay to have stuff. It's okay to enjoy that stuff. Try not to be in debt, because debt causes all kinds of suffering. And then lead a virtuous life. That's his prescription for, you know, it's not anywhere near as strict as for the monks and nuns. But it's like something we can all understand. It's like, yes, I can use the things I gain in the world through my virtuous work without wallowing in them. That would be a good word. Often people have so much stuff. And we all have things we like to do. And I'm a carpenter, right? So I have like six different kinds of saws. But I actually need six different kinds of saws. But I see myself walking through tool departments, which are like candy stores as far as I'm concerned. Like, ooh, look, there's a new kind of saw. You know, it's like so tempting just to go there and get more stuff. But I don't need it. So I usually resist that one. Okay. So using things consciously is a way to avoid the taints. By be conscious, I need to have this basic stuff. That's okay. Let's just not go any further than that. The next one is about enduring. This now we're getting into something a bit more difficult. What taints bhikkhu should be abandoned by enduring? Here a bhikkhu reflecting wisely bears cold and heat, hunger and thirst, contact with gadflies, mosquitoes, wind, the sun, creeping things. He endures ill-spoken, unwelcome words and arisen bodily feelings that are painful, racking, sharp, piercing, disagreeable, distressing, and menacing. While taints, vexations, and fever might arise in one who does not endure such things, there are no taints, vexations, or fevers in one who endures them. So he's basically, what he's saying here is, you know, you have a body, you have a life, stuff's going to happen that's going to be unpleasant. And sometimes the only thing you can do is endure them. Don't want to go out looking for them. We're not talking about, you know, wearing hair shirts and beating yourself with thongs and stuff like that. We don't want to overdo it. But sometimes things just are that way. We don't want to, if we're not careful, we put an enormous amount of energy into trying to avoid what is unavoidable. In our culture, this is particularly true when it comes to aging. You know, think of all the advertising and products that are out there in the world to try and make us think we are going to stay young forever. This is, you're trying to avoid the unavoidable when you do this. This is like, and it's deeply embedded in our culture, this idea. And we just don't need to go there. This is a choice we can make. You know? And understand, this is when we think about practice, we somehow think, you know, I got to have these sort of perfect conditions before I can practice. Yeah. Oh, my neighbor's making a lot of noise this morning. I can't meditate. No, just, well, now you're noting the fact that your neighbor is kind of annoying. And that's just something you know. That's what's arising in the mind. That's what's happening right now. So now it just becomes something you note. It isn't a problem. It's just something that's there that you have to endure. And if you're in that sort of situation where something is being very annoying and you notice that you're being annoyed by something, then it's quite skillful just to note the annoyance. Oh, look, right now, what's arisen right now in my mind is annoyance. Now it's just something that's arisen. It's not a big deal anymore. It isn't a distraction. It's just what is. I did a really long retreat, 6-week retreat at the Insight Meditation Society. And it was at the time when they were building, all during this retreat, a new dorm space right outside the window of my room. And I was doing a lot of practice in my room, sitting practice in my room at that time. And it was fascinating to watch my mind go through the, I can't do this anymore, blah, 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 get really annoyed. Why are these guys still doing what they're doing, blah, blah, blah. The mind getting all caught up in it. And then just going, noting, clanging, clanging, banging, guys yelling. It was like, that's just what was going on. You know, it's just, that's what was happening. And so that's what I noted. And it was a perfectly fine. It wasn't a perfect environment, you know. It was just, that's what it was. I was just, you know, got to noting how unpleasant it was. I spent a lot of time noting unpleasant, as a matter of fact. And it was actually kind of a really fruitful, useful retreat, even though it was like crazy at times. I later got to stay in that dorm once, which made it sort of nice. I said, oh, okay, I've been on the other side. So it's sort of like, oh, okay, I'm getting my just desserts. So sometimes that's the only thing we can do. instead of making these things that are unavoidable big deals that prevent us from practicing, we just go, you know, that's what the cards dealt today. Okay. You know, those birds are being really noisy out there today for some reason. Those, you know, it could be, and who knows, some little thing like that. It's just, that's what's going on. So that's what you know. That's fine. Yeah. Then we come to the next one. So this is number five of the how to deal with the taints. This is avoiding. What taints, bhikkhu, should be abandoned by avoiding? Here, bhikkhu, reflecting wisely, avoids a this is an interesting list. Here, a bhikkhu, reflecting wisely, avoids a wild elephant, a wild horse, a wild bull, a wild dog, a snake, a stump, a bramble patch, a chasm, a cliff, a cesspit, and a sewer. Reflecting wisely, he avoids sitting on unsuitable seats, wandering to unsuitable resorts, and associating with bad friends, since if he were to do so, wise companions in the holy life might suspect him of evil conduct. So we probably in our lives don't have to worry too much about wild elephants and wild bulls, you know, running through the forest, because these are forest dwellers, right? But I think the interesting one here is that he lists associating with bad friends. This is a very difficult thing for us in our culture, especially if you know, you've been doing the practice for a while, or perhaps even if you're new to the practice, and you sort of have these old friends, these people you used to hang out with, could be family even, that you know if you hang out with them, then you'll tend very quickly, out of habit of the sort of how that relationship works, to unwholesome habits of speech and mind, body speech and mind. It's just what happens, because we fall into that sort of way so easily. And so what he's talking about here, and sometimes it becomes quite skillful to avoid these people, to actually go, you know, maybe I don't really need to go to my high school reunion, because I know what's going to happen. Oh, you know, that's just an example I'm choosing. My high school life was not the best. or whatever it is, you know, it's like some group of people. And you know, or friends say, hey, we're all going to go out to the bar tonight. Why don't you come with us? Well, that was something, you know, 40 years ago, I would have said, yeah, let's go. Now it's like, shh. You know, so if the same people showed up in my life today and said that, I'd go, why do you want to do that? You know, so it's like we start to see, because of the first four, essentially, the first four have led us to see things being for what they are. And we know associating with these people, this doesn't work for me anymore. And it's difficult, because these are old friends, and maybe they're gonna even give you a hard time, especially if these are family. Families, this is really difficult, because now you've got family who, what's wrong with you? How come you don't want to come and, you know, have this big party and da 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 da? And they don't get it. That maybe you don't want to do it, not because you don't like them. It's just because I don't want to go there anymore. Difficult thing, family stuff. But this is where it fits, where sometimes we have to actually go, I just don't need to do that anymore. I don't want to go there. I know if I go, this is what's going to happen. You know, I have friends who have very difficult family situations, who are always talking about how they wish they could somehow fix their family. Now, let's forget about trying to fix your family. And we have enough trouble fixing ourselves, fixing anyone else. And this is not, it's not a fruitful place to go in the mind. So it's just, we have to just go, okay, let's step back. I mean, we, like I said, we don't have wild elephants and wild bulls in our life, but we all have wild friends, wild family. It's just the nature of being a human being. And it's a difficult place and where we have to work very skillfully. And it doesn't mean you don't care for them or love them anymore. It just means, you know, I need to maybe just take you in very small doses. Yeah, let's go have lunch together. That's fine. But no, I don't want to go for the 4-day family party at the beach, because I know where that goes. And just choosing how to draw those lines. So then we come to number 6, which is removing. What taints bhikkhu should be abandoned by removing? Here, a bhikkhu, reflecting wisely, does not tolerate an arisen thought of sensual desire. He abandons it, removes it, does away with it, and annihilates it. He does not tolerate an arisen thought of, and it goes through the three poisons. So this is, now we're into right effort. Now he's just actually discussing right effort from a slightly different angle. The first part, you know, avoiding, was the first part of right effort. Doing what you can to not get into situations where you know unwholesome mind states are going to arise. The second part here, removing, is, oh, now this has actually arisen. Now I'm, here's this story going on in my mind, and I need to do what I can to abandon it, to remove it. There are whole suttas that talk about ways to abandon things that have arisen like this, which I'm not going to go into today. But the primary one, well, the primary thing is one, that through mindfulness, we see that that's what's happened. Yep, here I am caught in that same old story where I always, I can feel my body tensing with fear or caught up in anger or caught up in sadness or loneliness or whatever that story, you know, the theme of that story is. Mindfulness is what allows us to see that that's what's happened, to see it really clearly. And then the most skillful thing to do, and the one that's most commonly talked about, is to then see if you can then just shift that energy. Like, you actually consciously choose to say, no, I'm not going to go there. I know this story. I know if I just continue along this mental path, I know where this leads. It's going to lead to unwholesome places, sad, worried, angry, lustful, pick your favorite kalesa. And because we know that, we say, okay, let's see, what can I do to change the story? You know, you can change it by doing concentration practices, my two favorite ways, doing concentration practice. In other words, taking, instead of having my mind wide open and sort of taking in whatever's arising, I choose, okay, I see what's arising. This is not skillful. I don't want to go there. I've looked closely at this story many times. Don't need to do it again. So let's just do really deep concentration practice instead. And I'll step back from this sort of wide open mental space to a very constrained space where I'm doing nothing but noting the breath and counting the breaths backwards from 10, which is quite an interesting concentration practice that just allows you to step back and just really see very clearly. The other thing is, especially if this arisen unwholesome mind state involves another person, often someone you are ranting about quietly to yourself or not so quietly to yourself, then if you can shift the mind to a wholesome mind state of loving kindness or compassion, or even sometimes sympathetic joy. You know, you're ranting because this person gets all the good stuff and you don't have any of that good stuff and it's not fair. If that's your rant, then shift that to sympathetic joy and feel joy for the fact that they're so doing so well. Just literally consciously choose to shift the mind state. This is, it seems contradictory to what is often thought of as how to do mindfulness practice. Mindfulness practice is always basic instruction here is just to stay with what's actually arising. And sometimes that just isn't skillful to wallow in that story yet again, to get caught in that unwholesome space, that arisen unwholesome mind state, that arisen taint, to use the language of the sutta, just isn't skillful. And I need to sort of be able to know when it isn't skillful and go, yeah, I'm not saying you want to be aversive about this. You don't want to avoid looking at them. But once you've looked at something really deeply 5 or 6 times, you've looked at it. I've been there and I've done that. Now it's time to step back and shift the mind state. So it can be quite skillful to not always just stick with what's arising. That sometimes you have to choose consciously to turn the dial, to shift the program. Let's go to a new station. Then finally we get to the number 7. And number 7 is about developing. What taints bhikkhu should be abandoned by developing? Here a bhikkhu, reflecting wisely, develops the mindfulness enlightenment factor, which is supported by seclusion, dispassion, and cessation, and ripens in relinquishment. He develops the investigation of states enlightenment factor, the energy enlightenment factor, the rapture enlightenment factor, the tranquility enlightenment factor, the concentration enlightenment factor, and the equanimity enlightenment factor. These are the 7 factors of awakening. These are a list that the Buddha comes back to over and over and over again in the sutta. It's part of the Satipatthana Sutta, one of the 4 foundations of mindfulness. Basically, what he's saying here is one way to avoid the taints is to consciously choose to cultivate wholesome mind states. Your mind can only have one thing in it at a time. The mind is a sequential processor. If the mind is in a wholesome state, then the unwholesome mind state can't enter, literally. So if I consciously choose to cultivate wholesome mind states, mindfulness being the first one, notice that's the beginning of the list. Mindfulness then allows us to work on these other ones that are in the list: tranquility, concentration, equanimity, energy, rapture, which is not a great translation of the word pitti, which basically means really curious, smiley, happy practice, and really enjoying the practice, cultivating the joy in the practice itself. So these are things that are, this is the last way, and probably, to be honest with you, the most pleasant of them, is that consciously work on developing these 7 factors of awakening. And there are things that as the mind becomes clearer and more crisp, more concentrated, you start to actually see these factors arising. And then that helps you cultivate them even more. Which is also, of course, this is what the Buddha talks about in Right Effort, where he's talking about if a wholesome mind state has arisen, these are all wholesome mind, then do what you can to maintain that wholesome mind state. Being mindful of it is the key. Here's back to mindfulness. I know I keep coming back here. But mindfulness is the key to everything. If I can be mindful of what's arising, then I can either shift away from things that are unpleasant, unskillful, or enhance and do what I can to maintain these wholesome mind states. I can make those choices. And that's the other way. And then I want to read something else from Joseph Goldstein here. Because the tricky part of this is that when we think of taints, we come up with the same old obvious list over and over again. And Joseph here actually in this, he's talking about impurities of thought. And he's talking about what we'll call the subtle taints, things that aren't so obvious that if we're not careful, even seem like wholesome. So it's interesting to reflect on what impurities means in terms of our practice. Some aspects of the word are obvious, like wrong actions of body and speech, and unwholesome thoughts of greed, ill will, and cruelty. But the Buddha also spoke of subtler impurities, such as being lost in worldly thoughts of family and friends, of reputation, of work. As lay people living in the world, we do need to think about these things sometimes. But very often we're simply lost in a kind of unnoticed reverie about them, drifting along in habits of thought that may not be particularly unwholesome, but may be inappropriate or unnecessary for the task at hand. Are they necessary? Probably not. So it isn't that they're unwholesome, it's just that they're not useful. And often we get caught in this cycle of thinking about, for me, it's like because I'm a carpenter, I'm thinking of my next job. Oh, how am I going to build it that way or this way? And should I use this kind of screw? You know, you get caught in this whole story about how you're going to do something. And then all of a sudden, you know, oh, gong goes the meditation bell. And you've been sitting there for 20 minutes figuring out how to put the trusses in correctly or something. You know? Not very skillful. And not harmful. It's not, like he says here, not particularly unwholesome, but inappropriate and unnecessary. Which is, it's a sort of a pleasant place you can get caught in. That just sort of like, oh, this is kind of nice. I'll just hang out here. And we lose track of the fact that we should be paying attention to the present moment. and then he goes on. And an even subtler level of impurity is when we're lost in Dharma thoughts about our practice and different meditative states. These thoughts are so seductive precisely because they are about the Dharma. And as with worldly thoughts, there are times when conscious, mindful Dharma reflection can be a big help on the path. But when we're simply lost in Dharma reveries or in judgments about our practice, they are not particularly helpful. How often do we get caught in that, huh? Thinking, yeah, I wonder, how is my practice going? And it could be better, it could be worse. It was better last week and now it's not so good. And comparing mind, and it's so easy. And once again, as I said, it's not that these are unwholesome. They're just not useful. They're not skillful in any way. These are what are called subtle impurities. It's like, we have to watch for, you know, and the thing about both of the things we're talking about here is often they feel kind of good. It's like, oh, it's kind of nice to sit here and just noodle away about this stuff a little bit. It sort of can be quite pleasant, but it isn't useful. It isn't skillful because when we're caught in these spaces, if we're not careful, we're totally removed from what's actually arising in the moment. The practice is now gone. It's just gone. It's the only way I can think of it. And so it's useful to think of that and be aware that that's a potential that we have if we're not careful. My piles of books are getting unruly here. And so then at the end of this sutta, this is the classic way to end these things. Bhikkhus, when for a bhikkhu the taints that should be abandoned by seeing have been abandoned by seeing, when the taints that should be abandoned by restraining have been abandoned by restraining, and it goes through the whole list, then he is called a bhikkhu who dwells restrained with the restraint of all the taints. He has severed craving, flung off the fetters, and with complete penetration of conceit, he has made an end of suffering. Another description of what it means to be enlightened. By penetration of conceit, conceit is the conceit that we're a separate being, the hardest one to get rid of course. And so what he's saying is, it is in this restraining the mind from these taints that enlightenment proceeds from. We have to learn how to do this so that enlightenment can arise. It's the what has to happen. This is what, when the Buddha at the very beginning mentioned, he said, because this is the direct path for the purification of beings. Once you've really purified, as in the detailed way he's talking about here, that's where the path leads. So I want to finish by reading a couple of poems. This is a book called One Robe and One Bowl, the Zen poetry of Ryokan. Ryokan was a 17th century Eastern, I think either Japanese or Korean, I'm really, I honestly not sure. I think in that sort of lineage. And they're sort of very short, pithy, Zen-like sayings. This is one short, very short poem I really like. It talks about what we're talking about here in a very sort of metaphorical way. The rain has stopped. The clouds have drifted away, and the weather is clear again. If your heart is pure, then all things in your world are pure. Abandon this fleeting world. Abandon yourself. Then the moon and the flowers will guide you along the way. So simple. Ryokan is, all of his poetry is like this. It's so, he's a renunciate who lives by himself in a little cell up in the mountains. And many of his poetries are full of imagery of the natural world that he makes into metaphors for the results of the practice or the way the practice goes. It's wonderful stuff. If you are curious about this, you can email me and I'll send you the particulars on this. This is another one of my favorite poetry books, so what can I say? And then, of course, I have to have something from Dana Faulds here, which once again is talking about, I think this is called Metamorphosis. Called beyond the confines of this chrysalis by a force I cannot see or name, I'm compelled by pain and something bigger than myself to leave the protection of all that I have known. There is struggle, doubt, an awkward setting forth. Finally, I break free of the cocoon and find myself surrounded by air and light. I dare to act, still not knowing what I am. Instinct, or maybe faith, bids me move forward, make the leap, explore this mystery of change and flight. I find myself with wings that dwarf my former world. Unfurled, they dry quickly in the sun. I, who expected to spend my days crawling, now teach myself to soar. Such a rush of wind and freedom. That first flight teaches me more than I had learned in a lifetime of crawling. Sounds like an enlightenment experience to me. So that's all I have to say tonight. May the beneficial energies arising from our practice here together today become the causes and conditions for the end of suffering and awakening of all beings everywhere. Thank you all for coming and sharing this time with me today. I always appreciate your presence in my life. See you again next week.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good night.
Night.
Namaste.
Thank you. Bye.